You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
In the 1950s, television emerged as a groundbreaking technology that quickly became a fixture in American households. It wasn't just an appliance. It was a powerful tool, a weapon of mass deception. Why? Because it had the potential to shape public opinion, influence perceptions, and control the narrative right in the comfort of our living rooms. The news that millions of Americans received daily often came from just two primary sources, Reuters and the Associated Press. Let's take a closer look at Reuters. Founded in 1851 by Paul Julius Reuter, this news agency quickly rose to prominence in Europe. By the late 1800s, it had established itself as one of the world's leading news services. The Rothschild family, known for their immense influence in banking and finance, became associated with Reuters. While it's true that the Rothschilds had extensive financial reach during that period, the notion that they fully owned or controlled Reuters to the extent some narratives suggest is more speculative than factual. In the United States, the Associated Press, AP, has long been one of the most significant news organizations. Established in 1846, AP became a not-for-profit cooperative, meaning it was owned and operated by its member newspapers. The idea that the Rothschilds or any single family fully controlled AP is not supported by documented evidence. However, the influence of powerful families like the Rothschilds, Rockefellers, and Morgans on the media landscape cannot be entirely dismissed. These families had vast financial networks and investments that often intersected with media, banking, and industry. Author Eustace Mullins, in his controversial book, Who Owns the TV Networks, argued that the major TV networks, radio stations, and newspapers were largely controlled by a small group of powerful families through their corporate conglomerates. While Mullins' work has been influential among certain circles, it's important to approach his claims with caution. The media conglomerates of the late 20th century did indeed include powerful corporations such as General Electric, Time Warner, Viacom, Disney, and News Corp. These companies had vast holdings that spanned television, radio, film, publishing, and even internet services. The concern raised by critics was that this concentration of media ownership could lead to a homogenized message, one that aligned with corporate interests and, by extension, the interests of the wealthy elitists who had stakes in these corporations. General Electric, for example, was not just a media company. It was also heavily involved in defense contracting. This dual role raised questions about potential conflicts of interest, especially when it came to how wars and military actions were reported in the media. If a company profits from defense contracts, can its media arm be truly impartial in reporting on conflicts? Then there's the issue of corporate sponsorship. Every television show needs funding, and that money often comes from large corporations. These sponsors have a vested interest in ensuring that the programming does not challenge their business models or political interests. As a result, the content on television can sometimes reflect a pro-business, pro-government stance, which critics argue serves to maintain the status quo rather than challenge it. This leads to the broader concern that while there may be many media outlets and voices, they are often controlled by the same underlying interests. The variety of channels and programs might give the illusion of choice, but if the same corporations control them, the diversity of viewpoints may be more limited than it appears. The intersection of media and politics is another area where concerns have been raised. The media has the power to shape public perception of political leaders, influencing elections and policy debates. The idea that powerful families or corporations could use their media influence to promote certain political figures or policies while suppressing others is a troubling thought. It suggests that the media, rather than being a neutral observer, can be an active player in the political arena. One of the most striking examples of this is the Bush family. The Bush family's rise to political prominence, from Prescott Bush's financial dealings in the early 20th century to George H.W. Bush's role as CIA director and later president, and George W. Bush's presidency, has been the subject of much scrutiny. Connections between the Bush family and powerful financial interests, including allegations of business dealings with controversial figures, have fueled speculation about the true nature of political power in America. The pursuit of global domination by powerful financial elites has been a subject of intrigue and concern for centuries. This idea traces its roots back to 1773, when a meeting allegedly took place at Mayor Amschel Rothschild's goldsmith shop in Frankfurt, Germany. It is said that 13 influential families, including the Rothschilds, Oppenheimers, Warburgs, and Schiffs, gathered to devise a strategy for global control. This plan, often referred to as the 3M formula, focused on gaining control over money, media, and the military. The formula's first two components, money and media control, were gradually implemented over the following centuries. Through strategic financial investments, the Rothschild family and other powerful banking families established themselves as dominant players in global finance. Their influence extended to the media, where they are believed to have played a significant role in shaping public opinion by controlling major news outlets. The third component, military control, has also been pursued, with efforts to privatize military functions increasingly evident in modern times. This shift has led to the rise of private military companies that operate alongside or in place of traditional government forces. These privatized military entities are often involved in conflicts around the world, raising questions about accountability and the true motivations behind their actions. But who are the terrorists these corporate soldiers are fighting, and where do they receive their training? One controversial answer points to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas, SOA, located at Fort Benning, Georgia. Until its name changed in 2001, the SOA was widely criticized for training Latin American military officers who later became notorious for human rights abuses, including torture, murder, and state-sponsored terrorism. The School of the Americas gained infamy as a school of assassins due to its graduates' involvement in numerous atrocities across Latin America. Among its most notorious alumni was Manuel Noriega, the Panamanian dictator and drug trafficker who maintained close ties with the CIA while facilitating the trafficking of cocaine into the United States. The school's role in training such figures raised significant concerns about the ethical implications of U.S. military aid and training programs. In the context of global terrorism, the role of media and political leaders in shaping public perception is critical. On the second anniversary of the 9/11 event, President George W. Bush requested an $87 billion increase in military spending. Around the same time, a video of Osama bin Laden, the alleged mastermind behind the attacks, was released to the media, portraying him as a continuing threat. The timing of these events raised suspicions about the manipulation of public fear to justify increased military expenditures. Osama bin Laden's background is complex and intertwined with geopolitical strategies. Born into a wealthy Saudi family with close ties to the Saudi royal family and the Bush family, bin Laden's path to infamy began in the 1980s during the Soviet-Afghan War. The CIA, along with Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, funded and supported the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against Soviet forces. Bin Laden was a key figure in recruiting and training fighters for this conflict, which was less about ideology and more about strategic control, specifically the control of Afghanistan's vast poppy fields, which produced the majority of the world's opium. The connection between the drug trade and global conflicts has deep historical roots. The opioid epidemic in the United States, which has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, can be traced back to the international drug trade that began in the 17th century. Queen Elizabeth played a pivotal role in establishing this trade, trafficking opium from India to China through the British East India Company. The profits from this trade were immense and helped finance Britain's global empire. By the 19th century, the British had granted opium monopoly rights to the Sassoon family, Jewish merchants who became known as the Rothschilds of the East. David Sassoon, in collaboration with the British Crown, profited greatly from the opium trade, particularly during the Opium Wars. These wars were fought to force China to accept British opium imports, leading to widespread addiction and social decay in China. The Sassoon family's connection to the British Empire was further solidified when David Sassoon's son, Albert Sassoon, married Aline Caroline de Rothschild, uniting two of the most powerful financial dynasties of the time. This marriage symbolized the fusion of the drug trade's profits with the vast financial networks controlled by the Rothschilds, extending their influence across the globe. Today, the legacy of the Sassoon and Rothschild families continues, with their descendants still mingling with British royalty. These families, who have wielded immense financial power for generations, remain part of Britain's elite inner circle. Many of them have been honored with royal titles like Sir, Countess, Baron, which symbolize their elevated status in society. However, their critics see beyond the titles in tuxedos, labeling them with far less flattering names. Liars, thieves, dope dealers, and mass murderers due to their historical associations with the global drug trade and other controversial activities. Across the Atlantic, the story intertwines with another powerful figure, Samuel Russell, who was a key player in the opium trade and used his wealth to establish Yale University's infamous Skull and Bones Society. This secretive brotherhood, funded by opium profits, has since played a significant role in American politics, with its members ascending to influential positions in the CIA, the Supreme Court, and the White House. One of the most notable Skull and Bonesmen was George H.W. Bush, who became CIA director in the 1980s. During his tenure, the CIA recruited Osama bin Laden to train Al-Qaeda and Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan. But these fighters weren't just battling the Soviet forces, they were also overseeing Afghanistan's multi-billion dollar opium trade. The heroin produced from Afghan opium funneled billions of dollars annually into Wall Street and U.S. banks, creating an unholy alliance between the drug trade and high finance. Authors like Alfred McCoy and Michael Levine exposed these dark connections in their books, which drew significant attention and even efforts by the CIA to suppress them. Levine, a former DEA agent with 30 years of service, wrote about how the so-called war on drugs was more about managing the drug trade than eradicating it. His first-hand experiences revealed a system where the largest drug dealers were often protected by the very agencies tasked with fighting them, while ordinary Americans suffered the consequences. The question arises, how was heroin smuggled into the United States during the Vietnam War? One of the most disturbing answers is that it was hidden inside the body bags of dead American soldiers. By the late 1960s, heroin addiction was rampant among U.S. troops in Vietnam, and the drug had spread to nearly 1 million Americans back home. Meanwhile, other drugs like LSD, mescaline, marijuana, and hashish flooded American streets and college campuses. But who was behind this massive influx of illegal substances? Prominent figures like Aldous Huxley, Timothy Leary, Allen Ginsberg, and Bertrand Russell became icons of the counterculture movement, promoting drug use as a form of liberation and protest against the establishment. However, their activities were not as grassroots as they appeared. Financing for this drug culture came from powerful entities like the Warburg Banking Family and the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS. Leary and CIA Director Alan Dulles, for example, facilitated the purchase of over 100 million doses of LSD from the Swiss pharmaceutical company Sandoz, which was connected to the Warburgs. Free samples of LSD were distributed not just on college campuses, but also at rock concerts where musicians encouraged fans to tune in, turn on, and drop out. This widespread distribution of drugs was part of a larger agenda to destabilize and control society, with the Rothschild-Warburg banking families and their associates at the helm. Dr. John Coleman, in his work on the Committee of 300, claimed that the Beatles were brought to America by the Tavistock Institute, a think tank that played a key role in shaping public opinion and popularizing drug use. According to Coleman, Tavistock's goal was to normalize drug use in America, turning it into a socially accepted behavior. Through their control of record companies and advertising monopolies, these banking elites packaged and promoted celebrity figures who glamorized drug culture. This effort anesthetized, addicted, and enslaved millions of people worldwide, creating dependencies on both legal and illegal drugs, from alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine to Prozac. crack cocaine, and heroin. Just as the so-called war on terrorism has been criticized as a facade, the war on drugs is seen by some as a controlled conflict, where the same entities fuel both sides. The peace symbol, adopted by the Flower Children of the 1960s, is another example of hidden agendas. Designed by Gerald Holtom, who was influenced by One World government advocate Bertrand Russell, the symbol was originally intended not as a symbol of peace, but as a symbol of death, a broken, upside-down cross. In Nazi Germany, this symbol was known as the Death Rune and adorned the tombstones of SS officers. The CIA's involvement in the global drug trade continued long after Vietnam. The agency's collaboration with ex-Nazis and Skull and Bones members like George H.W. Bush played a key role in training and supporting figures like Osama bin Laden. After helping to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan by 1989, the CIA shifted its focus to ensuring that the newly installed Taliban regime would manage the booming opium trade. This alliance, however, eventually soured, leading to the Taliban's fall from grace and the beginning of a new chapter in the complicated relationship between the U.S. and Afghanistan. On December 4, 1997, a meeting was held at UNICAL headquarters where American oil executives made a significant proposal to the Taliban. The plan was to build a pipeline through Afghanistan, a strategic move that would allow the transportation of oil and gas from Kazakhstan, just north of Afghanistan, to the Persian Gulf. Rothschild's Shell Oil and Rockefeller's ExxonMobil had already invested billions into the oil and gas reserves of Kazakhstan, but they needed a viable route to get their resources to market. However, the Taliban, who were in control of Afghanistan at the time, demanded a larger share of the profits. When the oilmen refused to meet their demands, the deal fell apart. Almost immediately, the narrative in American-controlled media shifted. The Taliban, who were once seen as potential business partners, were now portrayed as monsters, evildoers, and cruel oppressors of women. The sudden change in narrative was striking and suspicious. By July 4, 1999, President Bill Clinton took decisive action against the Taliban by freezing their U.S. assets and bank accounts. He also imposed trade sanctions on Afghanistan, further isolating the country from the global economy. Then, in February 2001, the Taliban made a surprising move. They destroyed most of Afghanistan's opium crops. This act was significant because Afghanistan was the world's largest producer of opium, which was the raw material for heroin. In response to the Taliban's destruction of the opium crops, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell announced in May 2001 that the United States would provide $43 million in aid to Afghanistan. Officially, this money was a reward for the Taliban's efforts to eradicate the opium trade. But there were concerns within the newly established George W. Bush administration that the funds might be used for more nefarious purposes. As the Bush administration grappled with these issues, a larger and more troubling question emerged. Why had the CIA, with its vast resources, been unable to gather actionable intelligence in Afghanistan for years? Despite having the authority to kill Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants for over 2.5 years, the CIA seemed unable to carry out the mission. Was it incompetence, or was something more sinister at play? Some speculated that the U.S. administration, backed by powerful banking interests, was controlling both sides of the so-called war on terror. George W. Bush ordered the invasion of Afghanistan. Within a month, the U.S. and British militaries had dropped 12,000 bombs, reducing thousands of buildings and homes to rubble and killing an estimated 8,000 Afghan civilians. An additional 20,000 people died from war-related causes such as cold, starvation, and disease. Despite the massive human toll, the invasion of Afghanistan was not glorified in Hollywood. There were no big-budget movies with triumphant soundtracks celebrating the campaign. Instead, the war left behind millions of starving people, thousands of homeless women, and a nation in ruins. Afghanistan, which was once the world's largest producer of opium, became the world's largest producer of heroin in the aftermath of the war. But why did peace and democracy remain elusive in Afghanistan? Critics argue that true peace and democracy would expose and threaten the lucrative opium and heroin trade, which had become deeply intertwined with global financial interests. The invasion of Afghanistan, they claim, was not just about toppling the Taliban. It was about ensuring the continued flow of drug money and securing strategic control of the region. In the aftermath of the invasion, the uncooperative Taliban warlords were replaced by the more compliant Northern Alliance warlords. Opium and heroin production soared, bringing in even more revenue. The U.S. also installed a new leader in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who had previously worked as a consultant for Unocal Oil. With Karzai in power, the path was cleared for the construction of the much-needed oil and gas pipeline through Afghanistan. The U.S. involvement in the Middle East did not stop there. In the 1980s, the United States had supported Iraq's invasion of Iran as a means to counter the spread of Iran's Islamic Revolution. During the Iran-Iraq War, America played both sides, supplying Saddam Hussein with chemical and biological weapons, while also secretly selling arms to Iran and funneling the profits to the Contras in Central America. In 1983, during the height of the Iran-Iraq War, a special envoy was sent to meet with Saddam Hussein. That envoy was Donald Rumsfeld, who would later become the U.S. Secretary of Defense. During their meeting, Rumsfeld and Saddam discussed strategies to reinforce Iraq's position against their common enemy, Iran. At the time, U.S. companies were supplying Iraq with the necessary components to manufacture chemical weapons, fully aware of how these weapons were being used against Iranian troops. By 1990, the geopolitical landscape shifted again when President George H.W. Bush allegedly tricked Iraq into another conflict. This time with Kuwait. The U.S. supplied Kuwait with horizontal drilling technology that allowed them to extract oil from beneath the Iraq-Kuwait border. This siphoning of oil enraged Saddam, leading to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Despite Bush's earlier assurances that the U.S. would not interfere, he quickly mobilized a military response, framing the conflict as a mission to liberate Kuwait. The wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other regions of the Middle East have long been viewed as driven by more than just the fight against terrorism. They are seen by some as part of a broader strategy to control the region's vast oil and drug resources, ensuring that they remain under the influence of powerful corporate and financial interests. America's handling of its toxic waste problem took a dark turn during the Gulf War, when the U.S. military began incorporating depleted uranium, a byproduct of nuclear reactors, into its munitions. These radioactive bombs were dropped on Iraq, leaving a deadly legacy of contamination. Under President George H.W. Bush, the U.S. not only devastated Iraq's infrastructure and water systems, but also crippled the economies of both Iraq and Kuwait. The aftermath of the war saw enormous profits for companies connected to Bush through the rationed Iraqi oil for food program and lucrative reconstruction contracts in Kuwait. But the devastation didn't end with the war. Bush Sr. followed up the Gulf War with a decade of crippling sanctions that cut off Iraq from essential medical supplies and other necessities, leading to the deaths of 1.5 million Iraqis, including 600,000 children. These sanctions, which were described as a form of economic warfare, took a horrific toll on the civilian population, yet were largely justified in American discourse as necessary measures against a brutal regime. Walk into a bookstore in the United States today, and you'll find dozens of books celebrating different aspects of the Gulf War, lauding it as a grand and noble endeavor. However, there are few books that challenge this narrative, pointing out the darker reality that this was a war that targeted civilians and led to the deaths of more than 250,000 people in Iraq. These books, often relegated to the back corners of bookstores, document evidence that shows the deliberate targeting of civilian infrastructure as a war crime. In March 2003, President George W. Bush launched the second Gulf War under the guise of liberating the Iraqi people. However, the reality of this conflict was far more complex. It wasn't just about removing a dictator or liberating a nation. It was about securing control over the Middle East, gaining access to its vast resources, and moving closer to global dominance. The war was also about money and enormous rebuilding contracts that would line the pockets of American corporations. One of the most shocking aspects of the Iraq War was the treatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, a facility that became infamous for the abuse and humiliation of detainees. Images of Private First Class Lindy England posing with naked Iraqi prisoners stacked in pyramids shocked the world. England later claimed that she and her comrades were just following orders, but the question remains. Why were Muslim prisoners subjected to such degrading treatment, and why was it done in a manner reminiscent of ancient rituals? To find the answer, one must look to the distant past. Iraq, known in ancient times as Babylon, has a long and tumultuous history. In 586 BC, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon led a brutal campaign against Jerusalem, destroying King Solomon's temple and enslaving the Jewish people. Saddam Hussein, Iraq's modern-day ruler, made the mistake of comparing himself to Nebuchadnezzar, a move that may have sealed his fate. The capture of Iraq and the downfall of Saddam Hussein were not only about oil and geopolitics, they were about settling an ancient score. On December 13, 2003, U.S. forces announced the capture of Saddam Hussein. The event was broadcast worldwide with a triumphant message, "We got him." However, many Iraqis believed the video of Saddam's capture was staged. They pointed out a glaring inconsistency, the presence of ripe yellow dates on a tree in the background of the video. In Iraq, dates ripen in July and August, not in December, leading to speculation that the footage had been filmed months earlier. As the war in Iraq raged on, the broader agenda of global domination began to take shape. The ultimate plan, according to critics, create an apocalyptic scenario that would exhaust and depopulate the masses through deadly viruses, global terrorism, economic collapse, and even nuclear war. In the aftermath, a charismatic leader would emerge, offering a solution to the chaos, a promise of eternal world peace. This leader would argue that the only way to achieve lasting peace is to eliminate the root causes of war. He would suggest that border wars can only end by creating a world without borders, religious wars by creating a single, unified religion, economic wars by establishing a cashless, debt-free society, and rivalries between rulers by installing a single world government. The tools of war, from handguns to nuclear bombs, would be abolished, and a global military force would be established to enforce this new world order. At this point, you might be asking yourself, why does any of this matter, and where is this going to end up taking us? Here's the thing most people don't realize. I believe these answers and more can be found within the pages of the Bible. Bible prophecy talks in extreme detail about where the world is going and what is going to happen. And it all starts with a man who is imbued with the power of the devil himself, known to the world as the Antichrist. This world leader will be the most popular man that will ever walk the planet Earth. He will be embraced by the whole world as the man of the hour. He's going to bring an apparent peace. He will rise as a finance man, a peacemaker, but emerges as the most powerful dictator that the world has ever seen. He will be a dynamic, mesmerizing public speaker. Apparently, this is the way he will literally sway the world, and it talks about him winning the hearts of the world, not just taking power over them, but he wins their hearts. He convinces them that he is the one who can bring world peace and prosperity and security. He's a convincer. He's able to persuade people like no one ever has before. The Bible also speaks of him as having supernatural power, doing signs and wonders. He's going to be a very convincing act. He's going to be the most attractive leader. There's a tendency because of our spiritual orientation to paint him in evil colors, and that is certainly valid, but it won't be apparent to the secular world. He is going to be the peacemaker. He's going to solve problems that no one has been able to solve to date, and as such will be embraced by the general population. He will be a media man's dream. He's not going to have to shoot his way into power. But people of the world, disillusioned with disorder and bankruptcy and all these individual and infectable problems and drive by shootings and revolutions and the manageable state of world affairs, he will welcome a great world leader to man with a plan. Every tribe, every tongue, every nation will worship him, then not just follow him, but worship him. It speaks of him as being a miracle worker, a person who will appear to be a very good man. In fact, many characteristics of a Messiah will be found in him, but I believe that as Revelation 13 describes, he will be personally indwelt by Satan. He is energized by and upon of a final scheme by Satan himself. When Satan's attempt to counter it, the real Messiah, in an attempt to thwart God's purpose. This frozen fire is portrayed in Revelation as a rider on a white horse, the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. His control of the world becomes so complete that no one will be able to buy or sell anything without his mark of 666 in their right hand or on their forehead. Anyone taking his mark is doomed to spend eternity in the world. All who refuse to take his mark, or to the mark of the beast, will be hunted, died, and killed. We will force all people to take a mark, called the mark of the beast, without which no man will be able to buy or sell. This will probably be linked to a global, cashless economy, which will be introduced in the wake of some economic calamity. This is not out of the realm of possibility within the very next few years. A strong government, then, will be able to control every person on the base of the earth, because when we spend money, they'll know where we spend it. When we receive money, they'll know when we receive it. Every purchase we make is going to be recorded. Cash is gone. Everything is digital. You start to pay for the groceries. Your number comes up. The lady or the man says, "I'm sorry, but your number's been deactivated." Then you go back to what the Bible says, and he's given power of the money so that people cannot buy, they cannot sell without his mark, without his number, and so on. According to the Bible, these 7 years will be a time of tremendous deception. The world media will promote this global leader and his agenda. During this period, all religions will be considered equal and unite into one compromised worldwide spiritual organization. It's interesting that this coming world leader will apparently be successful at causing a universal one world religion. That sounds very appealing to the modern mind, but it is directly antithetical to the teachings of Jesus Christ. In order to bring the world together as one, it's going to have to be done with a religion. I think we have that religion just over the horizon. I think it's going to be an occultic religion. It's going to be a pagan religion. It's going to be a religion that will syncretize all of the other religions of the world. We can naturally presume that he somehow is going to bring together the New Age, Islam, Catholicism, the apostate Christian Church, and so forth. There's going to be an integration politically and economically, but ecclesiastically or religiously. A second person referred to as the false prophet will rise to world power within this organization. This false religious leader will coax everyone into giving their allegiance to the Antichrist by performing great miracles. The true believer, those that are God's own, will avoid being deceived only by supernatural means. Jesus says, if it were possible, the very elect would be deceived. But personally, it's not possible. So the elect, that is those that are God's chosen, will be supernaturally protected from the widespread deception on the earth. This charming world leader's promises of global peace begin to unravel as the other three horsemen of the apocalypse ride across the earth, representing war, famine, and disease, which brings death to 1/4 of the earth's population. Incredibly, the real horrors have yet to begin. Catastrophic earthquakes, destructive meteor showers, and unprecedented natural disasters follow. Although people know these judgments are occurring because of their rebellion against God, they refuse to repent and instead cling even tighter to their false leaders for help. Hail and fire rain down from the sky, causing 1/3 of the earth's vegetation to burn up, 1/3 of the sea creatures to die, and 1/3 of the ships of sea to be destroyed. 1/3 of the fresh water supply becomes poisoned, while the sun, moon, and stars are darkened to 1/3 of their light. In 90 AD, the prophet John saw these future events unfold in a vision from God. He obediently recorded them in a section of the Bible called Revelation. There he describes the visited creatures not of this earth that come to torment people. That torture is so bad that people beg to die, as if all this wasn't enough. An army of 200 million kills another 1/3 of the remaining population with fire. During this whole 7-year period of time, there will be earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, tidal waves, natural disasters of every sort, which will produce great devastation throughout the earth. In addition to nuclear warfare and all the horrors that go along with it, there will be plagues, famines, diseases. The Bible says that more than half of the people who will be alive in the earth will die within that 7-year period of time. Man is now saying, "I am autonomous. I am master of my own destiny. I can handle everything." By the way, he's going to get the chance. That's why the tribulation comes to pass, because God speaks to autonomous man and says, "You have bragged about how you can run the world. Here's your chance." And he runs the world into the ground. Except those days be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. During the first half of the tribulation, two miracle-working prophets of God, based in Jerusalem, tell the world's population why God is judging them. They also proclaim God's free gift of salvation, available through belief in God's Son, Jesus Christ. Exactly 3.5 years into the 7-year period, The world leader kills these two prophets and enters the rebuilt Jewish temple in Jerusalem. There, he demands the entire world worship him as God. Those carrying the 666th mark become infected with awful sores. All sea life dies, and the remaining fresh water becomes polluted. People chew their tongues in pain and curse God, refusing to turn from their evil deeds of murdering, stealing, witchcraft, and sex outside of marriage. The worst earthquake in history strikes, literally leveling cities of the world. Real stones weigh more than 50 pounds each, rain down from the sky, crushing everything with their devastating impact. Finally, the armies of the world gather together in the Jezreel Valley to instigate the infamous and deadly Battle of Armageddon. This all-out confrontation almost annihilates mankind, but is stopped when Jesus Christ returns to planet Earth in the clouds. So I guess that's it. Like I said, I don't want to scare you guys. I just want you guys to know what time we're in and what to expect next.